invention of the name Thomas Edison may prompt a light bulb of inspiration in your mind. It should, because Thomas Edison developed that wonderful little device that's dotted throughout all of our homes, the long-lasting, practical electric light bulb. Edison is considered one of the most prolific inventors in history. He holds over 1,000 United States patents in his name, as well as many patents in the United Kingdom, France, and Germany as well. Edison is credited with numerous inventions that contributed to the mass communication world, and in particular to the field of telecommunications. He was the one that came up with a concept and oversaw the implementation of an electric power generation and its later distribution to homes, to businesses, and to factories. And of course, we recognize that. Living very close as we do here to a power plant, we recognize the use that that has in our modern, industrialized, and developed world. The first power plant that Edison oversaw was on Manhattan Island in New York. Yet life for him could have been so much different. He was the seventh and last child of Samuel the Iron Shovel Edison, quite a name, Junior you could add on as well, and Nancy Matthews Elliott. While at school, the young Thomas Edison's mind often wandered, and that resulted really in a teacher, the Reverend Engel, being overheard one day as saying, "That's an addled guy, confused, mixed up, can't ever bring his thoughts into focus." Apparently as well, the teacher sent Thomas home with a note that said, "Your child is dumb. We can't do anything for him." Mrs. Edison wrote back, "You do not understand, my boy. I will teach him myself." And she did. After 3 months, official schooling, that's all he lasted, his mother embarked on this course of homeschooling for him. How successful she was is proclaimed of Edison's many discoveries. Edison later recalled, "My mother was the making of me. She was so true, so sure of me, and I felt I had something to live for, someone I must not disappoint." On the great biographer Ida Tarbell's 80th birthday, someone asked her to name the greatest persons she had ever met. She responded, "The greatest persons I have ever met are those nobody knows anything about." On the front rows of those greatest persons who nobody knows anything about are mothers. Confirming this thought in the New York Times, it was once asked to help a club of women decide on the 12 greatest ever women in the United States. After due consideration, the editors of the New York Times replied, "The 12 greatest women in the United States are women who have never been heard of outside of their own homes." Abraham Lincoln is credited with the quotation, "No man is poor who has a godly mother." Even a Spanish proverb says, "An ounce of mother is worth a ton of priest." I don't think we'll be arguing with that statement. Today, on this Mother's Day, I set before you one example of a mother in Israel. Dating back to Old Testament times, her name was Rizpah. We've read about her today, 2 Samuel, the chapter 21. She was one of King Saul's concubines. In other words, she was one of the king's official mistresses. She very likely was an approved mistress, approved by Mrs. Saul. Now, it's a practice we abhor. And we know it was not according to God's plan and not according to his command, but it is the way that things were done back then. We may be correct in reaching the conclusion on the basis of the meaning of her name. Her name means hot or glowing stone, that Rizpah was a very beautiful woman. Without doubt is the fact that she bore 2 sons to King Saul. But whenever we get as far as the length of 2 Samuel chapter 21, King Saul has died. There's a new king on the throne. That's David, the new monarch of the kingdom of Israel. Rizpah comes along and she occupies center stage on one of the blackest spots of King David's 40-year reign as king over Israel. Our text in 2 Samuel 21 verse 1 through 14 is unusual. But strange though it is, I believe it does teach us some valuable lessons about parenting. But before we examine in some detail what Rizpah can teach us, we'll make a couple of preliminary comments. You'll find in 2 Samuel 21, 1, there was a famine in Israel at this time. In fact, it stretched over 3 successive years. So at the end of these 3 years, I'm sure the situation was pretty dire. People starving due to the lack of food. It was a most terrible circumstance. And David and the rest of the people around him looked at this, what was happening, and they said, "This is absolutely awful. There must be a reason at the back of all of this. I wonder what is the problem here?" And they concluded correctly that God was punishing them. So David seeks the face of the Lord in prayer, pours out his heart to him, asks God for the reason behind their punishment. And God's response was, "This famine has been sent into the land of Israel as my response to what happened during the reign of King Saul. An evil event had taken place, and this is punishment for it." What had happened was the former king, King Saul, had killed a group of people trying to wipe them out, every last one of them, total genocide from the territories of Israel. They were the Gibeonites. Joshua 9 verse 3 through 21, sketch in the necessary background. And from that passage we learn that the Gibeonites, back in history before Saul's day, they had pulled a rather clever scam on the children of Israel. Israel had moved into the land of Canaan. They were clearing the land according to God's command of their enemies. But the Gibeonites, knowing that we are right in the line of destruction here, they sent a group of people to try and strike a treaty with Israel. But they were far from up front in their approach. In fact, Joshua 9 verse 4 records, they did work wilily. They worked out a very elaborate deception. They misled the Israelites. People today talk about smoke and mirrors, indispensable items to create a kind of deception. And these Gibeonites, they spun a story to the soldiers that they were from a faraway place. And they presented evidence to prove that they had traveled countless miles to get where they were in the days of Joshua. Old sacks, they showed those. Old broken wine bottles in the sacks. Old shoes they were wearing. Old clothes as well. Food that had dried up and was moldy. And the Israelites under Joshua were taken in. And without supplicating the throne of God and asking for God's wisdom on this issue, they signed up to a treaty with the Gibeonites. No consultation with heaven led directly to compromise on earth. In Joshua 9 verse 15 we read, "And Joshua made peace with them and made a league with them to let them live. And the princes of the congregation swear unto them." It was a binding treaty, and it was violated in the days of King Saul. When Saul decided, "I have no purpose for these Gibeonites. They have tricked my country in the past, and now it is time to take retribution upon them." The lesson here: God takes our promises seriously. When we vow a vow to the Lord, he expects us to keep it. It didn't matter that the Gibeonites had deceived them years ago. It didn't matter the treaty they signed up between the two parties. That treaty they had agreed was foolish. It didn't matter that decades had rolled on since this event. They made the treaty under oath. And God expected Israel to keep their promise, not so much even to the Gibeonites, but to the Lord. And this applies to us. When we make marriage vows, God expects us to keep our promise to him and to our mate. When we sign our name at the bottom of a document, he expects us to rise to the obligations that we accepted then. When we take an oath to tell the truth in a court of law, he expects us to tell the truth. And so the passage we have here, it contains a vital reminder in this day when people are so adept at lying and walking away from their responsibilities, we need this important message. God expects us to keep our promises. There's a second side issue that should not be missed in the incident. The seven young men who were hung up and killed in 2 Samuel 21 may not have had to die. David, in verse 3 of the chapter, summoned in the Gibeonites and he asked them to name a punishment that comes to your mind that would lift the curse. But once again, it seems that David did not, on this issue, ask God what he should do. In his desire to fix the problem, David may have been running ahead of the Lord, and as a result, seven young men died for something that they had never done. The principle is this: wisdom dictates that we always check with God first, that we seek his face before we spring any plan into action. As a result of these actions, Rizpah's two sons were taken from her. They were publicly executed. Their dead bodies were put on display. Those bodies would hang there, and eventually they would be eaten by the vultures. And obviously, this was intended to be a powerful object lesson for all of the people. Now, our concern today is not with this object lesson, with the vital lessons we can learn from the life and from the activity of Rizpah, this mother in Israel. Notice first how she guarded her children. The protection in which she engaged. There is no doubt that a mother has a special heart for her children. And even here it's illustrated, death does not sever this tie. The word compassion in the Hebrew language comes from the root word womb. Isaiah 49:15 points up a very unlikely scenario. The prophet says, can a woman forget her sucking child that she should not have compassion on the son of her womb? Seems incredible, seems so inconceivable. Once a woman has felt life in her womb, there's a bond that is never broken. People sometimes don't understand that a child who dies before or shortly after birth is as devastating a loss as losing an older child. Mothers who have lost a child at any age, even when the children have grown up and developed into adults themselves and moved maybe thousands of miles away from home, they never forget the pain. They deal with it, but they do not forget. They remember anniversaries. They place flowers at graves. A conversation engaged in can suddenly bring back the floods of tears. And I suspect that if we were to be examining our own hearts today and work out our own family circumstances, even represented here, there will be moist eyes in this building. The pain of loss remains. And if we can understand Rizpah's pain, we understand why then she did what she did, why she came out. And with her two sons hung up there, she camped by the bodies of her two sons, and she determines she is going to keep the vultures away. She was powerless to stop their execution, but this is something that she can and something that she will do. And it's a mother continuing to show love even in death. There's even more here than a message about the reality of grief. I'm taking up the suggestion of Bruce Gottsche when he says that Rispa points here to a spiritual lesson. The fact that mothers need to work to keep the vultures away from their children. Our children face vultures every day they live. They face pressures to conform. They face the vultures of substance abuse. They face the vultures of immoral behavior. And people out there are telling them, it's what everybody else is doing, and you need to fit the mold. You need to run with the common pattern. Let's address the issue in a more defined way. We need to guard our children from the vultures of a godless life. We live in a day when our children are being fed a diet of pluralism, the erroneous teaching that all religions, all faiths, are the same, equally valid. Therefore, we have no business in criticizing any faith, never mind exposing its errors. And even if we come at that teaching of pluralism from a purely practical angle, when we go out and say that, well, yeah, all faiths are the same, even though they are teaching contradictory facts, we are really telling our children all faiths are the same, that really, faith is nonsense. It's a rubber nose. Bend it whatever way you want, it doesn't make much difference. We live in a religious world, but it's a world full of man-made religion. And each of them boils down to this man, by his own efforts, accomplishes his own redemption, and we need to guard our children from this. Man-made gods are not gods at all, and we can best guard our children from this godlessness by introducing them to the true and living God as early as we can. Isaiah 44:6, thus saith the Lord, the King of Israel, and his Redeemer, the Lord of hosts, I am the first and I am the last, and beside me there is no God. We can guard them from the vultures of godlessness by demonstrating our own faith. When we're involved as well in a Bible-believing, Bible-preaching church, we guard them too when we wrestle in prayer for the souls of our children. When Robert Ingersoll, notorious skeptic, was in his heyday, two college students went along to hear him giving one of his lectures. As he walked down the street after hearing the lecture, one said to the other, well, I guess he knocked the props out from under Christianity, didn't he? The other said, no, I don't think he did. Ingersoll did not explain my mother's life. And until he can explain my mother's life, I will stand by my mother's God. We must guard our children from the vultures of a godless life, also from the vultures of a trivialized life. Over 100 years ago, G.K. Chesterton asked, can anyone tell me two things more vital to the race than these? One, what man shall marry what woman? Two, and what shall be the first things taught to their first child? Chesterton went on to comment on the fact that a mother's task is not trivial. It's tremendous. And he said, the daily operation surrounded her with very young children who needed to be taught not so much anything, but everything. Then he railed against those people who begin to talk about this domestic duty as not merely difficult, but trivial. And dreary. We may pity mothers for the hugeness of their task, but we can never pity them on account of them having so little to do. We live in a world where life is trashed on television, through video games, hundreds, thousands of times every week. We live at a time when the fact that abortion is ending all over our planet, human lives doesn't bother most people. People attack and kill each other without giving it a second thought, and they stand in a courtroom with no sense of remorse. It appears they feel nothing. We live in a time when the other guy is always the one to blame when something happens. We make poor choices then when the choices backfire. We start pointing the finger, extending the arm, and shifting responsibility to somebody else. The result of all of this, people have trivialized life. Nothing matters. No one takes responsibility for their own behavior. Life loses its preciousness. We must guard our children from these vultures. We must guard our children as well from the vulture of an undisciplined life. One of the buzz concepts of this age is live for the moment. Just do it. Indulgence, not sacrifice, is the watchword. Consumption, not restraint, is the battle cry. And we need to teach our children how to appreciate what they have and to realize that the things that they have cannot determine who they are. We live in a day of permissive parenting. Oh no, well, we can't really step in and do that and say that, and because, you know, we don't want to hurt our child's ego. We reckon our children will grow out of whatever stage they are in. And we pass up on comment, if not even chastisement, whenever they're clearly in the wrong. But we've mistaken permissiveness for love, when in reality it's the abdication of love. Over 200 years ago, Susanna Wesley, mother of John Charles Wesley and others, in fact she reared 19 children, but she was devoted to the task. She had 16 rules, and I think, with their practical import, they're still relevant today. 1, eating between meals is not allowed. 2, as children, they are to be in bed by 8 p.m. 3, they're required to take medicine without complaining. 4, they were to subdue their self-will so that they might be open to God's salvation. 5, teach a child to pray as soon as he can speak. 6, require all to be still during worship. 7, give them nothing that they cry for, and only that which is asked for politely. 8, to prevent lying, punish no fault which is at first confessed and repented. 9, never allow a sinful act to go unpunished. 10, never punish a child twice for a single offence. 11, commend and reward good behaviour. 12, any attempt to please, even if poorly performed, should be commended. 13, preserve property rights, even in smallest matters. In other words, respect what belongs to others. 14, strictly keep all promises. 15, require no daughter to work before she can read well. In other words, finish your education. 16, teach children to fear the Lord. I think those are good. We need to be more active in protecting our children from those vulture-like influences in the world that will destroy them. So this was the protection which she engaged, the protection that she employed. Notice her diligence as well, the perseverance she exercised. 2 Samuel 21 verse 10 tells us that Rizpah stood watch from the beginning of harvest until water dropped out upon them out of heaven, and suffered neither the birds of the air to rest on them by day, nor the beasts of the field by night. Perseverance is stamped all over this 10th verse of 2 Samuel 21. The text could mean a couple of things. It could mean that the bodies hung there until the drought had ended, the rains came. That would have been the indication the plague of the curse had now ended. RISPA then might have been out several days, might even have been out several weeks at this. But the majority of Bible scholars feel that the text here is best interpreted as the body's hung there from the beginning of the barley harvest right into the rainy season, which, well, the barley harvest would have began around about April time. The early rains didn't arrive until October or November. It would mean that RISPA was out guarding those bodies for around 6 months. We cannot definitively state which view is correct, but this is evident. Whatever length of time it was, RISPA saw things through to their conclusion. She didn't set out quickly and then fizzle out. She stayed the course. She persevered. And the key to being a good mother is the same kind of diligence and perseverance. Monica, the mother of Augustine, was an example of diligence and perseverance. She was a wife of a pagan, but her prayers changed the world. She prayed every day for her husband, and her prayers were answered when he became a Christian shortly before he died. Her youngest son, by the name of Augustine, was 18 at the time. He was already keeping bad company. He was involved in a most immoral lifestyle. The last thing in the world that he wanted was to be a Christian. He didn't want to give up all of his illicit pleasures, and this whole God thing didn't make any sense to him. During the next 15 years, Monica prayed fervently for her son. She never wavered in expectation that someday he would become a believer in the Lord Jesus Christ. She prayed, she fasted, she loved him with an unwavering love. She encouraged him in a study of rhetoric. She encouraged him to take a professorship in Milan in the hope that when he got to Milan, he'd sit under the preaching of a famous bishop there, Ambrose, and hear the gospel from his lips. And her hope was realized. In his early 30s, Augustine was converted. Eventually, he became a bishop himself. He actually laid the foundation through his teaching for that system of Bible doctrine that we believe to be known as Calvinism. Augustine realized that my mother's diligence on my behalf had much to do with my conversion. In fact, her diligence rescued me. How about us? Are we diligently battling for the souls of our children? Are we surrounding our children with prayer? Are we persevering? Or do we become intense only in a crisis? Day after day, RISPA stayed at her task. I'm sure there were days she was tired. I'm sure she was dehydrated on occasions. I'm sure she was even sick. But she kept at it. Chuck Swindoll once was commenting on the startling rise in the divorce rate. He especially underscored the fact that 10 years ago, for every wife or mother who walked away from her home and responsibilities, 600 husbands and fathers did so. However, only 10 years on, for each man who walks out, 2 women do. Then he said, once upon a time when the going got tough, the tough got going no longer. Contrary to our great American heritage, many of today's citizens would rather switch than fight, or more honestly, quit than stick. That which was once not even an option is now standard operating procedure. Now it's, if you start to sink, jump, don't bail. Or, if it's hard, quit. Don't bother. The greatest problem in the home today is lack of perseverance. We need more of the spirit and determination of RISPA. The protection, the perseverance. Finally, notice her reward, the portion that she enjoyed.
There was nothing that could give Lisbeth her children back. There was nothing that could plug the hole that existed in her heart. But we find in 2 Samuel 21:13, because of her actions, the king took notice. He instructed her son should be buried in the proper fashion. She achieved her goal for them. And not only this, Rizpah became a model mother for others who would come after her. No matter what your circumstances, this is what she's teaching us. You can only do the best you can. Rizpah could not bring her children back, but she could make sure they were buried properly. You may not be able to undo failures in the past, but you can change what happens from here on out. You may not be able to bring things back to the way in which they were, but you can make things better than they are. You may not be able to solve your children's problems, but you can stand with them. Things may not change overnight, but they can change. And you in this meeting may be wrestling for the soul of your child today. It is worth the effort. You may be fighting for their future happiness today. It is worth the effort. The reward of diligent parenting is children content and focused and faithful. It's a reward that does not come easily, but is worth whatever it costs. So what lessons do we apply from this passage today? Well, we ask ourselves questions. Are we diligently guarding our children from the vultures of life? Or have we abdicated our position of influence to the television, and the television is actually bringing up our children, or even to the school, and the school is doing it, or to the community, and they are bringing up our children? Do we need to help our children become more disciplined, more focused? Do we need to have more of a hands-on approach? And another question, what are our children learning from us? Are they learning to take responsibility or make excuses? Are they learning to walk faithfully or always take the course of the least resistance? Are they learning? There is one true God who has sent a son in great love for us. The son has sacrificed himself on the tree of Calvary, an atonement, the only one to cover our sins and our many transgressions. Another challenge, young people, what kind of parents will you be? What kind of example are you giving to your friends? And maybe you say, well, you know, in my home, my parents aren't much of an example. Well, are you using this as an excuse, or are you using it as a springboard and saying, I am determining that this slide away from God in my family is going to stop with me? I am going to be interested. I am going to be committed. I am going to be sold out for God. And maybe you're saying, well, you know, boundaries are drawn in my house, and I like to press them, I'd like to break them. If your parents are setting boundaries and drawing lines in the sand, stop complaining and thank God. Don't be envying those who have parents who don't care. And their children can multiply their sins on the way to a Christless eternity, and they don't care what they do. You, in parents, your setting boundaries have been granted a great gift for which to be grateful. Maybe as a parent you're on the verge of giving up, ready to throw your hands in the air. Choose diligence. Refuse to surrender what is good and right for that which is easy. Well, where do we start? The clear suggestion is start by resting in the Savior's arms. 1 Peter 5 and 7 applies to this field as any other field, casting all your care upon him, for he careth for you. Entrust yourself to him if you're not saved, entrust yourself to the salvation that he extends. Draw upon the strength that he offers as well. Give him the broken pieces of your life and let him begin the process of putting you back together. It's an awesome responsibility. We do need help, but the Lord is near unto all who call upon him. Why not call upon him today? And to those who find Mother's Day to be a painful reminder of a terrible loss, understand that even though we cannot plumb the depth of your pain, we do know it's real. But even in your pain, do something for the rest of us, those who are parents. Remind us over and over and over again that we should appreciate what we have. Then you, like Rizpah, will speak volumes even in the midst of your pain.